Okay.
So we're ready to go.
Okay, so we'll start up this workshop. All the materials are on the web. And I'll be going back and forth to different content if you want to try to follow. But I'll try to be clear and guide you through all of this. So the workshop was titled Towards a Common Language for Systems Practice. This was a title and a definition that was co-developed by Jack Ring and Gary Metcalf. And I'm not really sure what it meant. And so my goal here is to act as a facilitator and a guide so that the group can try to uncover what the territory is and the bounds of the territory. The intent was to run this somewhat like the Banathy-style conversations, like the IFSR conversation is. It's modified because we don't have a shared context. And so what I'm going to do is provide some context for you, and then we can try to work through that in the individual groups. So just starting off, the outputs for this meeting, by the end of today, what we want to do is have input that could be used at the IFSR conversation and at the ISSS meeting. And so this is kind of a movable feast where everyone is not the same participants. We're starting off on this journey, and we'll need some artifacts to move forward. So the central theme, normally in the conversation we have a trigger question of some sort. The question that we're trying to answer is, which questions should the system science working group explore that would lead us towards a common language understanding across, now I paraphrase this, systems practice, systems science, and systems thinking. And that's a larger domain than systems practice. And so somewhere in there we should actually get to practice. And so what we're going to do is I'll do a lecture first, and then we'll break out into groups of 4 to 5 people, and you don't have to be in this room, you can do wherever you want. And what we'll want to do is create these index cards. PowerPoint may be a good way to do this with a headline and the body. But the question is, with your group, to create a concise question for further inquiry. And this is, as we go into this meeting in Austria with the IFSR conversation, we'll end up with a large list of questions. Also helpful if you provide some guidance. And the sort of things I'm interested in the guidance would be, how'd this question come about? So you're actually going to spend some time actually trying to craft this question. But it'll be, you know, we started talking about this and led to that, and then this is why we came up with this question. Which reference sources can we cite so far? And remember, this is because not everyone is going to be in this, not all the same people are going to be in the conversation continuously. So this is an artifact that when the people get to Austria, they can look at the list and go, okay, the last people looked at this had this body, and they had these questions they're focused on. And then what issues or challenges require deliberation? So what is it that makes this question interesting, right? So the hope is that in your groups that you'll generate this. I had that work product should be somewhat self-explanatory so that future workshop participants who are not present today can pick up the thread. And I'm going to be at both those meetings, but I will not be in the groups. So we need these artifacts to move forward.
And so can you say more about that first bullet under guidance? How did this question come about? You mean like what kind of other questions led to this question, or what method did we use to come up with the question? Or
More about the questions that led to the question, because you're as opposed to focusing on the answers. So in the conversation, they'll have 3 to 4 days to actually work on content. Yeah. But the question is, what should they be working on? And so we kind of need to give them a ballpark, which is, you know, okay, we had this discussion about common language on system practice, and so you may end up saying, well, what do you mean by common language, and then what do you mean by system practice? And we'll have 3 or 4 hours maybe to discuss this afterwards, discuss this in the group here, in the breakout groups. And so we're just trying to summarize it in a kind of standard format across the groups.
Okay.
So the agenda, I'll have go quick around the room, everyone introduce themselves, because I think we had different players from yesterday. The lecture, I think, will take 3 to 4 hours. Could be 2 hours, it could be 4 hours, we'll see how it goes. I can do it. I can expand or I can contract, and we'll see how much people know and how much they want to delve into stuff. Then we'll break sometime before lunch or at lunch at the very latest, and we'll have this discussion where you do generative dialogue, you do some strategic dialogue as required, then prepare for the readouts. And so at the when we get towards the end of this period, so right now if we have three groups, looks like we have enough for three groups, and we're going to end at 5 o'clock. We'll see if we run over, but let's target that. So at 4 o'clock, we'll come back and we'll have people tell us what the questions are, what the discussion was about. 30 minutes before that, so at 3:30, you should prepare, make sure all your slides are prepared and stuff to come back, right? I'll explain this generative dialogue and strategic dialogue in a minute. If you have one person identified as your scribe, and then you have a spokesperson come and talk about it. I'll come back to this lecture content, and I'll describe the conversation process. And so, Banathy originally was frustrated at conferences because you get a lot of people that come and they give stand-up presentations, this sort of stuff, and you never get a lot of the conversation that that really provides value. And so the idea was that all that conversation you normally have in the coffee breaks where you actually learn stuff is the stuff you want to try to capture in these conversations. So he has a differentiation between what he calls a generative dialogue and strategic dialogue. Strategic dialogue is normally what we do when we're actually trying to get towards an end, right? So when you have fixed and agreed ends in mind, decisions of the planners involved determine the permanent limitations, so you've decided on the boundaries, and you can do this external design on the material as a passive recipient of engineered limits. So you're actually designing something. In the case of generative dialogue, what we're doing is trying to get the creation of collective consciousness, collective inquiry that focuses on the thoughts, values, and worldviews of the group and creates a flow of shared meaning, shared perception, shared worldview, and a social milieu for friendship and fellowship. What this means for the conversation that you will have in your groups of 4 to 6 people is that you're going to try to get to a shared worldview. And at minimum, we want you to converge on questions. Right? If you can't even agree what the questions are, we're not going to get to any answers. So that's why the focus is trying to just spend 3-4 hours trying to get down to what are the questions that are important to answer that the next people can work on. And the next group can look at this and they go, well, you missed some questions, or yes, we can work on these, or we can work on some of these, and we can delay some for other projects. But that's the approach. So to start off a generative conversation, and this is the thing when people that are coming to Austria, the first thing that I'll have is to start off the generative conversation, have each person in the group respond for about 5 minutes to the question, by which path did I come to this workshop? And that's a pretty open-ended question. Some people say I came here by plane. Some people say, well, when I was 4 years old, I wanted to be a scientist, and you know, I did this and I did that. But when you have these other conversations, a lot of the background material starts ending up. So, I can tell you that I started off, and when I got to university, I was math and chemistry, and in 6 weeks, I dropped out and changed to commerce. And it's that sort of things like, oh, well, that kind of influenced me. I can tell you my PhD dropout from UCLA. You know, these sort of things kind of, oh, that's why David's that way. But what happens is that when we get this question, and we actually try to get people actually talk for 5 minutes about yourself, about your background, and that's why we have it in small groups, then you get that understanding about, oh, then they understand this, they don't understand that. So as an example, John's introduction here, he started off in physics. It's like, oh, actually, I didn't know that. So it's like, okay, now I see how the worldview shifts a little bit because he has a background in physics first, right? So that's what we'll do in the generative conversation. So let's go back up here. And so let's just do a quick introduction.
The time schedule is not realistic.
No,
it adds up to 9 hours.
Yes, I'm going to, but we will finish, the lectures will finish before lunch, I guarantee.
Good.
Okay. So, I'm David Ng, President of International Society for System Sciences. My day job is at IBM. And so 26 years from IBM, where the they permit me, or they kind of don't. So I've had periods when I've had support from IBM to do research in the system sciences, particularly around 1998 to 2000, 2002. Since then, I actually haven't had any organizational support from IBM. And so we have this interesting thing. I was at the lunch table yesterday, and we had these people talking, and they're talking about IBM products, and well, that's not my role here today. I actually sell the products, but that's not my role here. So that gives you some background as to why I am the way I am. So so we'll go around and just have a quick introduction. James? This is a short introduction. This is not the five-minute introduction.
This is not the 5 minutes.
No, it's just a short one going around the room. Just
okay, so how different than the introduction we did yesterday?
Not different from yesterday. So just okay. Who you are and why you're here.
Why am I here? Because I'm interested in what makes systems work, and why is it that sometimes when I do use a method that worked before, it doesn't seem to work in a new situation. So I can't figure out what context differences there were that were made it not work there and work before. So that always fascinated me that there ought to be kind of a way to figure out the way to get there. But you can't always use so-called lessons learned because they're not always transferable.
Wait.
Wayne Hydrickson. I've had an interest in systems science for some time. And I think I'm interested in trying to figure out how to bring it more into the practice of systems engineering.
Bud?
Yeah, okay. I have a long history of constructive things and building and designing things, starting in the computer industry, both in compilers and programming languages. And Gerhard knows my history. And then designing hardware and processors, and then designing rather interesting applications. I designed the automatic train control system, which was the world's first microprocessor control system for the Swedish railways, which is still operating after 30 years with the same architecture. Designed high voltage power dispatching systems, automotive components, participated in that in a coupling device that every four-wheel drive vehicle around the world uses, I presume. So, I have that engineering aspect and design quite a bit in architecture, I would say, more than anything else. In 2002, I was asked by, and then I became more in the systems engineering when I over married from applications, but 2002, I got a challenge from Dinesh Verma at Stevens to develop a course on systems thinking for their systems engineering program. But that started my interest along the parallel path. And exactly as Duane, I'm interested in how we could get systems engineers to use the ideas from systems thinking and system science in their systems engineering work. Thank you.
Garrett?
I'm Garrett Christ. I have a very similar line, but actually I'm 50 years now in computers. I have a Master of Science in Computer Science from Philadelphia. And then I was with IBM and went through all the things, formal definition of programming languages, microprogramming, relation to hardware, software engineering with respect to building a large software engineering development model. Include this, I did my own, and the lab, we did an interpreter for that to really enact the whole model. And I realized that we are changing the world with our system, so I gradually moved to systems engineering and then human and cultural relations, and that's where I am now. The second purpose or reason I'm here is that I'm the General Secretary of the IFSR, International Federation for Systems Research, where INCOSI lately got and became member, and here we try now to bridge between the more technical INCOSI people and the more, let's be without any derogative, a little bit esoteric system thinkers to some extent, and that will be one of the challenging. And I've been organizing these IFSR meetings or conversation, David implied to since 1994. So I will talk about it now, but whoever wants to know anything or subscribe, I've seen all kinds of conversation going good and bad. So over lunchtime, if somebody wants, we can discuss a little bit and also ask questions, why not, and so on. I can tell you, well, we tried that in 1998, it didn't work, or things like that. So that's also the reason I will organize the next one again, which essentially sent out. That's my position.
Thanks.
Bob Siegel from the GOSI Washington Metro Area chapter. Did 20 years of system engineering on complex systems for the Department of Defense, and looking for that common language that bridges the system thinking. And I think the natural world and that type of system, we have a lot to learn. So I like the linkages, and I also think that helps us when we work in our community of interest to come up with more common language to connect what's going on in nature and biological or geophysical types of things. So it helps me with my value proposition.
Walk in, Bruce Bioff. Now I have come out of retirement. I failed at retirement. Retired 4 months ago from Whirlpool Corporation. Failed at retirement. Failed retirement. I came back and started a small consulting firm in systems and have worked 30 years for about Whirlpool, Rockwell, Eaton, General Electric, so a kind of a pantheon of large corporate systems people, mostly in big industrial or consumer systems.
I'm Richard Martin, and I'm here because James Martin told me I had to be here. I have an information systems consulting business, and now these days all my clients are small businesses that I've had been doing business with for well over 20 years now. I act as the kind of CEIO for all of their technical needs, business management stuff, all of that kind of stuff. I've also been involved with ISO. I'm a convener of an ISO working group on enterprise architecture. I've been doing that for about 10 years. We've run through several fairly nice standards in that period of time, and we're still working in various other aspects of standards in the enterprise domain. And I've also been doing some research with a colleague at Indiana University on the formalization of enterprise architecture.
Okay,
Alain Prisonnier.
I'm CTO at I should be retired.
Not yet. Don't. We have more time if you are not.
It should be very long to explain what I have done. In the 70s, I was a technical manager for switching systems, playing IT and so on. And in the 80s and 90s, I was responsible for quality assurance for Embark software and systems in satellites in Europe. And I discovered that people have no real methods to engineer, in fact. So, and I decided to create my own company, Map System, in 15 years ago, something like that, to deploy systems engineering knowledge and practice in big companies in Europe. And also, I had some courses in the USA for international companies some years ago. And I defined a workbench that implement the systems engineering processes and as well as dependability processes, and I defined a niche model with that, and so the tool is existing now, but it's very difficult to sell that because people need about 15 days training before using that. So, and I am interested now I am writing, in fact, my own book that will be a practical guidelines for the community. And I've written about 400 pages, but it's just a sort of
practical.
It's too much.
Right.
And I am participating in the bookcase project, and I'm writing one of the core parts of the book, of the C-book, the system definition, in fact, with a mission analysis, stakeholder requirements, and architectural, and so on. So, so I'm interested in this kind of thing.
Jennifer? But Bruce already introduced himself. He just moved positions.
Yeah. Do it again.
The checklist is the same.
Yeah, right.
Jennifer Wilby, University of Hull in the UK, in the business school. I started in it when I moved to the States. So I was, first of all, in teacher training, and then I was biochemistry, and then I was political science and database publishing and urban planning. And now I'm in a business school in the UK, teaching there. But also, when I was in Master's Cybernetic Systems in San Jose, I found ISSS. This was back in the late 80s, and done various positions in IISS. And last year I was president, and for many, the last 8 or 9 years, at VP of Administration. Doing conferences, membership, things like that, and that's where I'm. What I'm back to. After.
So you after failed at retirement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You failed at retirement from my.
It is a distant dream. There's a yellow brick road. And it's always uphill. Always walking uphill.
John.
So this is a why question, and I should answer it according to Aristotle's four causes. I worked for National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for a long time doing ecosystem databases, and I got very, very frustrated because it seemed like just having the data didn't improve management in any way, or didn't tell us anything more about how to understand nature and ecosystems. So I was ecosystems and global change was full-time in the field. So it seemed like, you know, in 20 years we were understanding the progress at all. So, and I had these ideas about a deeper understanding of living systems. So I discovered, I got involved in 88, I guess, with James Lovelock and some conferences around that, and started thinking about, you know, the whole different way of seeing nature. And then discovered Rosen, I guess, much later, around 96, 95. And then he died before I could meet him, and I started working with his daughter. So I've been pursuing the relational theory issue yesterday. And the reason for coming to this meeting was David. Called me at home and, before the Denver meeting and said, well, you know, we have this agreement in COSI, and could you represent ISSS at the Denver meeting since I live close by? And so I thought it would be dead boring and a complete waste of my time. But I figured, oh, what the heck, and there might be something interesting. Because I thought it was just, you know, a bunch of people were very practical and wanted to do things. Working on theory. Well, turns out that's been a much richer experience, I think, than many of the discussions at ISSS, because philosophers have a tendency, and theoreticians have a tendency, to just invent new foundations all the time. You know, and I was so impressed with this group. It's like, oh my God, you guys actually want to do something. You know, and that's his final cause. You know, that's the end product, trying to organize the stuff we're going to work on. And most of the discussions have been involved. We haven't had that. It's just endless philosophizing about, is this the right philosophy to present? So I want to get something done. And I want to end up with some software that helps us manage ecosystems. I'm doing research in India now.
Kent Williams, the reason why I'm here is because I am trying to create shared understanding. It all started with fractals years and years and years ago, and I began to think that there was a systems set of principles, and then my boss asked me a couple of years ago, he said, is systems engineering really engineering? And he said, all the other engineering can go back to first principles. How does systems engineering go back to first principles? And so that's what prompted me to actually answer his question by getting involved in system science. And I've missed a couple of opportunities to do it before, but tagged in on it, I guess, at the last year's or the year before symposium, about one day. And my objective is to take this information ultimately and give my clients a way to understand that their business problem actually can be traced all the way down to a solution that can be talked about in system terms consistently, whether they're in this area or this area. So I don't have to keep changing my methods and my tools and my approaches because, I bought things that were not bought as a purchase, but bought into the idea of customized one-off methods.
I'm Mike Singer. I was trained as a chemical engineer. First worked in energy areas, actually, started developing a sense of long-term projects and vision when I was working on the fusion project, nuclear fusion, before I worked on solar. And I guess in that regard, when I was working on it, it was always 20 years in the future. Now it's 40 years in the future. So
and that was 40 years ago.
So what you're contributing is worse.
That was the point. So hopefully we all can relate to that. So I've also worked in spacecraft and general environmental issues akin to what John was talking about. I think what's most germane here, interest to what several have already expressed, when I was at JPL, interested in the common language to such an extent that it might be achieved for system engineering, management of system development, methods, tools, practice, as well within the JPL environment across the organization, and a little bit more broadly into NASA.
I'm Janet Singer. I'm also involved with IESS, Vice President of Research and Publications. I'm trying to give a snapshot of the mix of why I think the way I do. My father was a mathematician and worked in OR and systems analysis, did mainly defense work. So he was actually employed to do systems work, and through all those years was mainly defense. So I grew up around questions like, what's the difference between operations research and systems analysis, and systems research and operations analysis? So when I went to school first, I was in the liberal arts, and I ended up in comparative religions. And my sense was that the practical view of seeing religion in terms of what humans do and their practices and their understandings was the common thread that tied everything together. And so it's very interesting to see the pragmatic coming back as the integrative perspective. Then I later went into mathematics, got a master's in math, and then went into a couple of engineering schools looking for integrative programs, and none of them were sufficiently integrated for my taste, but I think now the world is coming around finally to the need for real integration.
And on the phone, Jack?
I seem to have lost them.
Okay. Is there anyone else on the phone? Okay. So when we go to breakouts, I'll encourage you to work with people which you are not really familiar with, so you can get a wider perspective, and you can reintroduce yourselves in a new and different way. Okay, so I'm going to go over some content. First, I'll just give you the outline of it. So as the baseline, so everything's on the web.
You did that.
The baseline, and this comes from conversations that James and I have, I actually hate defining stuff because I believe in systems of ideas. And so the bookcase Overdue System Science article that was written, it got distributed, and I didn't pay much attention to it, and Gary Metcalf took it on and actually passed it around a little bit and took it to some people from the IFSR, who my understanding was they kind of go, what do we do with this? And Gary said, well, it's kind of like a Wikipedia entry. And they go, well, it's a Wikipedia entry, it's probably okay. And so then I started looking at it seriously and realized that we need to do something. As a result of doing that, so the approach that Gary and I kind of fell into, and it's been consistent with the work we've been doing at COSI up to this date, has really been historical. This is how system science has been evolving. This is how system engineering has been evolving. John Warfield had a foot in both parks. Some people know of work in soft system methodology, this sort of stuff. And so that was kind of the way that the papers have been written. And the white paper that Gary wrote is very much historical. In order to get to the next state, we need to do something different and more content-oriented. So I ended up writing this blog post, which is not one that I'm proud of, and it's actually trying to duck the problem. Because, as I said, I don't like defining stuff. And so what I did was I went and through someone I met at the IFSR, Charles Francois, there is the International Encyclopedia for Cybernetics and Systems. And so what I did is I kind of went through that, and I started pulling out content from that. And so if you want a definition for system science, it's there and this sort of stuff. And so I posted that as a response to this bookcase. So that is the baseline, and it drove into this. But then we started talking about this workshop, and it's like, well, actually, I don't like the definitions that Charles wrote. Like, they're valid, but for being practical and doing something about it, I didn't think they were very helpful. So I started working on this workshop. And so things I want to talk about. I want to talk about. I'm going to give the first lecture, which was when I give this to master students that know nothing about systems. It's about a 45-minute lecture. I expect could do it shorter here if people agree. But I got involved in Finland at Aalto University, where I'm a PhD student. But they called up and there's this new program called Creative Sustainability. And Finland has been innovative in the way that they've been designing their education program. And in particular, Aalto University is the merger of three universities. It was the Helsinki University of Technology, so the MIT of Finland, the School of Design, and the School of Economics. And so to create an innovation university, they actually merged three universities. The Creative Sustainability Program is a new program. It was the first program in that new university. And so my son actually just applied to it. It's funny, he's applying for master's programs. He's a material science engineer, and he's going around and he's looking at the Aalto University stuff, and he says, oh, I want to apply to the Creative Sustainability Program. I said, you do understand that that was the program I was teaching? And he said, no, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But to graduate in that program, it's actually truly interdisciplinary, because you get your degree in engineering, or in real estate business, or in economics, or in design. And they're talking art school design or product design. That's where you get your degree from. But in order to have this major, you have to take a series of courses that is shared. And so it's really interesting. And in the research paper that I wrote, this is for the ISSS paper, I discovered that I had to start writing about all the contexts. Because I was teaching the course, and so people actually think they're going to read about the course and go to this paper, are going to find out, well, first I have to explain Finland, and then I have to explain this merger, and then I have to explain that you're going to have an engineering degree, but you're going to be taking these courses with design school students. And so James and I were kind of talking about Sweden before and how it might be different. I said most of my experience is in Finland, but in Finland, these sorts of things is kind of like, they're kind of okay with that. So they have the department, they have the overlay, they have the degree, all sort of stuff, but they have this new program called Creative Sustainability. And the idea behind the creative sustainability was that at the foundation, they had two courses that were in systems thinking, and they put it into the program, but they actually didn't know what it was. And this is, Finns are really agile in that way. They will start up on projects. And so there were two courses that were created. One was named Systemic Thinking of Sustainable Communities, and the other one was called Systemic Thinking for Planners and Designers, with no content. And so they're looking for someone to teach it. They had one Finnish master student who had taught something in the engineering school, but he had done it in Finnish. It was heavily based on soft system methodology. And he said, at first, it was too much work to translate all that into English. And then, I don't have time to do that, and I also don't have the breadth. And so they said, okay, I wanted to write this course. And it's kind of like, well, I'm working on my PhD, I'm kind of busy. But, okay, so I check with my friends. That's the way Finn works. I check with my friends, so I want to work with these people. And they said, no, they're fine. They're good people to work with. Okay. And then they're checking with their people, of course. It's like, oh, David's okay to work with. And then we have this conversation. Okay, we'll teach these two classes. And this is like about April, May time frame. And they say, great, you're going to teach the classes? We'll talk in August. Okay, what's the course? Now, this is the way the Finns actually work. I spent a lot of time with them, which is it's whatever you teach. And it's like, okay, so for me, this is an opportunity to create the course. I always complain about other people's courses. It's kind of like, okay, people can now complain about my course because I have no legacy, and I have this body of work, and so how should I teach this course? Part of the course was one of the criteria for this course was if it was going to be current, and I'm kind of this practitioner who's an academic. It should include journal articles from systems research and behavioral science from the past 5 years. It should include from systemic practice and action research. I look at Kubernetes. But if you're looking at creating a whole new course, like I'm not going to go, the stuff, my complaint about system science is it's frozen in the 1980s. We have Russell Aycoff, we have Warfield, we have all these people, it's 1980s thinking, so why don't I start and try to create something that's current? For those of you who will find out what I listen to in music, my complaint about music when you listen to radio stations is that they're playing things from this century. You listen to, you know, rock music, stuff like that, they play stuff from the 80s and the 90s, it's like, you're playing things from this century. So we're kind of, this is the opportunity and the context in which I got to work on these courses. So the interesting part, and what turned out really well, was when we started talking about systemic thinking of sustainable communities versus thinking for planners and designers, there's a split there that's kind of natural. The one that's for planners and designers is actually, I think, where the systems engineers will actually be more comfortable. You can actually define the body of knowledge, you can define the experts, you can define what the goals are, and then you can go at it. And so it's mainly planning techniques, Aycoff interactive planning, those sorts of things. So that was the second course. The first course, and I'll get into some of the details on this, are when you have a community, so you're talking about urban change, these sorts of things, and there are no right answers, you don't know who the constituents are, you get hit across the head with all these agendas that are just off the wall, and in that point, that's when you start getting into a lot of more of the dialogue methods and the conversation methods. And so I'll describe some of that, and we're actually doing more in this conversation oriented towards this systemic thinking for sustainable communities approach than we are for the planet designers. So those references are there, I'll come back into this lecture. So I wrote a blog post on which is the one that I sent in advance. And this is actually the key one that I'm gonna get to when people start looking at philosophy of science. One of the things I think I'd like to have picked up, and actually I would like to see in the bookcase if it actually squeezes its way in, is a discussion about epistem, techne, and phronesis. And that'll lead us towards the discussion on praxis. So I'll give you some background.
Yeah, just one point about teaching in Finland.
Yes.
Certainly, my experience in teaching courses in Finland is that the last session has always been the best one because the dialogue is rather free in the sauna bath.
Oh.
Every course I've taught in Finland
winds up there.
That's where my cultural barrier goes. I can't take heat, so I don't do sonnets.
That's one on the roof.
Just a small aside.
Thank you. So this one I'll come back to and talk. I'll talk some on that. I also then 2 weeks ago I gave a talk at a group in Toronto called Design with Dialogue about inquiring systems, and so I'm going to use those slides and talk about them in that way, and that'll give you the designer inquiring systems. Then I was going to write a blog post, which I didn't, and now this is stuff I appended, which is things I think you should know, and this is particularly towards the themes of the presidential address towards humans. A lot of my thinking is influenced by A.K.A. Wenger's Communities of Practice book. I think everyone should actually read it. And I was looking at it, and I'm going to write the blog post. And what I found interesting was the first chapter, the introduction is rather complete, but the footnotes in the first chapter are even more complete, because he lays out the entire social theory, and that's why it's taking me longer to write the posts. Some of the pages are available on Google Books, and so I've linked to those pages, and I'll talk about them a little bit. But I definitely want to get there before lunch, right? The direction that we're headed, and since I actually do, I'm a solution architect at IBM, so we talk about the baseline, we kind of talk about the transition, the future direction to the target state is going to emerge. And so as a result of your conversations about what you've heard, what you think, you can decide what's relevant, what's not relevant. My purpose here is to give you a point of view. There's what I call blog people and wiki people. I'm a blog person, so I will give you a point of view of which you can agree or disagree, but we're kind of moving towards a wiki sort of thing where we're going to need some convergence, right? And so I'm going to give you a point of view. For the people that are going to Austria, the entry ticket to go to the conversations has generally been a position paper. And we didn't make you write a position paper to come to this workshop. That's not the style. We can decide in the future whether that's appropriate or not appropriate. But as a result of my blathering on here for a long time, you're going to get an opinion, you're going to have a position. Because I like Dave's work, I like this, like that. This is irrelevant. You know, this is totally off the wall, that sort of stuff. So. To provide the foundation, I'm going to flip over now to this. I do everything on the web.
Go to the second tab.
Second tab. Okay. So I'm going to give you a view of what I think systems thinking is about, and some definitions. And Russell Acuff. Is the way I entered into systems thinking. And so I find him helpful. I actually don't necessarily practice all the stuff that that he does, but it's an interesting place to start. So so Acuff wrote originally he wrote this in 1981, and this is one of the chapters that's actually in Acuff's best. You can go either way. But what he writes about is the machine age and the systems age. Okay, so he's actually using those terms. He doesn't say systems thinking or systems science, that sort of stuff. He says, in the machine age, we are focused on analysis, which is taking things apart. We're focused on determinism, so we're going from cause to result. Reductionism, where we go from the whole into the parts. And on mechanism, how things kind of work together. And so then he talks about, okay, we have this idea of the systems age. And the systems age, where he defines the nature of a system. And so it's, again, you have to be careful with the language here. If people ask what a system is, this is not actually what a system is. It's the nature of a system, which is a whole that cannot be divided into independent parts. Okay, that's going to be the shortest definition. It's useful. People kind of get that. Okay, so there's four parts of systems age. They're kind of counter to the machine age. Firstly, systems thinking. I'll come back to that in a minute. Secondly, expansionism, which is actually against reductionism, so as opposed to going into the system, going out of the system. The idea of producer-product, I'll come back to that, and the idea of teleology, and teleology for him is goals, right? It's a study, it's a philosophy of ends. Okay. So talk about systems thinking. And this is the interesting dividing line for me when we start talking about people claim that they're systems thinkers. And then you talk to them, and you might have had this experience, and you go, this person doesn't understand systems at all. Well, what is it about systems that they don't understand? And so I like Acuff's definition. The fundamental thing about systems thinking is that synthesis precedes analysis. Analysis is taking things apart. Synthesis is putting things together. So what you want to do is do this part first. So what does that mean? Three steps. Firstly, identify a containing whole, which is a system, of which the thing is to be explained as a part. So you have the system, and you've got what's normally the environment around it, and people focus on the system. And this is like, no, what you want to do is take the system, and the question is, how does that work in the environment, right? And this is the part that most people, when they get into systems, they fail at, is they go, oh, the system, and they always look inside the system. And so the part that I found that that separates the what I would call the systems thinker from the people that don't is that the people think about outside the system. They think about the environment. Secondly, explain the behavior or properties of the containing whole. So you're going up to the next level, and you're talking about not what you said the system was, but everything is around the system. So you take an example about, okay, so I live in Toronto. We're talking about the transportation system. And it's like, okay, what about the budget? What about the city budget? Well, the city budget is not part of the transportation system. It's part of the larger whole in which the transportation system is included. And so, yes, we could discuss how to make transit better, but if your budget is fixed, you're not going to be able to do a lot of things, right? So you end up having to discuss that containing whole. And so then explain the behavior properties of the thing to be explained in terms of the role or function within the containing whole. So now we're working down. So again, in that example, why is the transit system so bad? Could it be because underfunded? Well, the people driving it, you can't blame the people. So I have this interesting test. My wife doesn't like me doing this, but I talked to my hairdresser, a woman that cuts my hair, who's not very educated. She, you know, but she voted on the wrong side of the civic election. And I tried to figure out. I really want to understand why it is she did that. And so she was complaining about she cuts hair at a senior's home, and she was complaining that they have pickup service, so you can phone, dial a ride, and you know they send it, and saying, oh, they're always late, you know, and they can't keep on schedule, stuff like that. And so I was trying to understand about this, and they said, okay, now let me understand this. So you voted for cutting funding on transit, but you want more service from the transit system. And she said, yes. Like, I don't think there's something. And so that's when I don't get into the arguments over there so much, or because to me, I see the inconsistency. You can't cut funding and expect higher levels of service, right? To me, that's just kind of natural, but she doesn't see it that way. And so she's not a systems thinker, that's fine, but trying to understand why people are like that. I hate to say as a Canadian, sometimes understanding American politics, again, this sort of thing, right? But that's the basics of systems thinking. The idea of producer product comes into, I'll give the classic parable that was handed down from Singer to Churchman to Acuff, which is kind of against this idea of determinism. And so in systems thinking, we talk about oak trees and oaks. Okay, so how do you produce an oak tree? Okay, you get an acorn, you get some water, you get some soil. Okay, I'll give you those. Will you produce me an oak tree? No, you need sunlight. Okay, what else do you need? You need oxygen. Okay, so you kind of go through this whole thing, and philosophically they've had this discussion, and the basic lesson here is that I can give you all of the inputs to create an oak tree, and you might not still produce an oak tree, because it's an emergent property of the interaction of all those parts. Only God creates trees, right? So you run into these sorts of questions when you start talking about producer product in systems, because people say, oh, we gave you all the inputs, so we specified all of the processes, so therefore we should have this output. It's kind of like, nah, not always. So that's Acuff's chapter summarized. Actually, probably did it faster than you can read it.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
You know, your example, I mean, it's possible that someone could present a systems engineer with requirements, you know, reduce the cost of transportation but provide better service, and it may be possible to figure out a way to do that.
It may be possible.
Because there may be a lot of waste and whatever.
But if they're going to cut, if they're actually going to cut funding, then where do you get the resources to do the reorganization of the transit system?
But I'm saying that, you know, it's not necessarily impossible.
It's not necessarily impossible, but it's difficult.
I mean, it sounds, you know, illogical.
She also might be working on the motivational system. You know?
Yeah,
get
yeah.
Get rid of these guys, and then we'll give them funding when we get some people who can think.
Yeah. Well, now you've hit exactly the thing that happens in your systems thinking is what is the system you are trying, the system of interest, right?
Yeah.
Where is the boundary?
Right.
And what's inside. But as soon as you define this in the Acoff way of doing it, you say, this is a system of interest, you're already going outside the system of interest.
Right.
Yes?
One thing that if my friend Bill Schindel here from yesterday's presentation proudly said is that there have been people who come after Acoff and said, well, what he was really describing is simply the machine age was a class of the system age. Before people really understood ways of mathematically representing, or even in design, mathematics representing, they had to make some of these assumptions in order to take and get a practical solution to the problem. So if you look at the bigger picture, they were simply working on a subset of what Acoff divided, because if you really look at the practicalities of what they did in Latin, it wasn't just black and white. It's just one.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
There's been much writing after Acoff that said really he was talking. It wasn't just black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
There was an era when
yeah.
what we understood had to be done this way because it's the best knowledge we had. And as
yeah.
we got better, we gravitated mm-hmm. into a world that understood better the right hand side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So as I said, I have my disagreements with Acoff, but for people that know nothing about systems, this is the shortest answer I can give on what is all systems thinking stuff about. Yeah.
Not quite. I would add at least something. Emergence, I think,
yes.
is one of the things which comes to it. But you can explain that in that term somehow. Then.
Yeah.
And that's not, fully agree, because if you go outside of the system, you actually have a bigger system which you are looking at.
Yes.
And
yes.
you have sort of the system of concern.
Yes.
And the system which influences that sort of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Bruce, you weren't here yesterday, but. Inspired by John's work with Rosen's material, we were talking about how Rosen said that the view had been, from the machine perspective, that the simple is the general and the complex is the special, and that he turned that around and said that, as you're saying, that the simple, the machine
yeah,
perspective,
right.
is
a specific case.
Right.
And as time went on, I don't know why I have to represent the system engineer model-based guys here, is that as time went on, people on the mechanistic side embraced and are embracing the stochastic side on the right and saying that's the general case. Many people change their mind over the years and said that's the general case. And we just do a simplification down to things that are mechanical for a case of getting a solution because of what we know.
Again, this is me trying to separate out people who sometimes claim to be systems thinkers, but they don't sound the same as some of the other people I've talked to, and so the issue about looking outside. So the reductionism is actually the biggest criticism of the machine age, and so the question really is the view reductionist or not? And we talk about the design of a system. And I'll cover some of that later. We get into system learning, and so do you design a system that learns, and that sort of thing. Okay.
So in your chart there, the reductionism should be lined up with the expansionism.
Expansionism, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's the order that he actually discusses them in.
Okay.
So.
Correct him, and it makes it.
Yeah. I just say
read the book.
As the decades have rolled on, the opposite of the analog reductionism was expansionism. Or integrativism,
mm-hmm.
and many of the systems engineers who work on the most complex systems in the world today—they just treat those as one part of a loop that's constantly running.
Yeah, yeah,
there is no
yeah.
such thing as just reductionism.
Yeah, yeah.
There is
no.
Thing
no.
But again, I hate to say it. Acoff in the 1980s
tended to make it very black and white and draw a hard line and say it's
this way
or it's that way.
Yeah.
So the time check, we're halfway into the break period. Do you want a good time to?
Yeah, let's take a break.
Okay. So let's come back. It's about 8 after. So let's come back 12 minutes at 10:25 or something.
Okay.